Do you think people should have fewer children because of climate change? We'll talk with a guest bioethicist who says yes, and welcome your questions and views. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm curious, did you consider the future of our planet when you decided whether or not you would have children, or when you thought about how many children you might have? Would having just one child or no children at all be the right way to proceed in an age of climate change? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Our guest is Travis Reeder, the Assistant Director of Education Initiatives and a Research Scholar at the Berman Institute of Bioethics at Johns Hopkins University. He's also the author of the book, Toward a Small Family Ethic, How Overpopulation and Climate Change Are Affecting the Morality of Procreation. And he recently wrote a piece for The Conversation titled, Bioethicist: The Climate Crisis Calls for Fewer Children. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on, Joy.
Thanks for being with us. So, I'm just for the spirit of full disclosure, how many children do you have?
I have one. I have an absolutely beautiful, fun-loving 2.5-year-old.
Yeah. And did you think my partner and I, are only going to have one child because of climate change?
Oh, gosh, it's a long developing saga. We were married for 10 years before we had our first child. And we went from very young people who thought we would have all the kids we could take to slowly becoming concerned about a variety of issues. And as we both finished our graduate degrees and started thinking about a family, we actually weren't sure we would have any. We thought maybe we would only adopt rather than create, you know, new people to put on the planet. And so after a very long discussion, we decided that we would have one biological child. And if we still want that big family later, we will adopt.
Yeah. Well, in the spirit of full disclosure, I'm the youngest of 8. So my parents were not, were not considering these things. But it was a different time, too. I think, you know, my mom grew up on a farm and, you know, I did not. But, you know, I think that mentality was still there. Also Catholic, you know. But why? Why should people have fewer children in light of climate change?
Well, so there's a really kind of broad answer, and I'll start with that, and then you can push this in the direction you want. But the kind of broad answer is the total global emissions is a product of per capita emissions, so emissions per individual times the number of individuals, right? And we've known that, right? That's not a secret. That's just kind of basic logic about how total emissions work. But there's been a real taboo surrounding the topic of population, especially anything that sounds like population control or infringing on intimate sorts of procreative rights. And so, you know, climate change is still relatively new in terms of how serious we are about it. You know, it's only a few decades old. And so in that time, no one has been willing to talk about population. The last real serious conversation we had kind of in the media, in politics, was right around the 70s. Some interesting historical things here and there, but it really was kind of killed as a topic by a variety of circumstances. And so we've been attacking this climate change problem completely unsuccessfully, focusing on reducing the per capita emissions side. And we're doing really badly, and the problem is becoming more and more urgent. And so my co-authors and I kind of say, hey, you know, there is this other variable that we could talk about controlling.
Yeah, well, so how does my husband and I do not have any children, but if we would have had 5 children, why would that have been bad for the planet?
So there are kind of 2 directions you can go here. And so the towards a small family ethic idea, what I talk about in my book, is really about exactly that question. It's about this individual action, right? Should I have any kids? Should you have any kids? And it's much less worried about this kind of large population policy question. And so for that question, we should ask ourselves to think about a couple of things. So one thing we should ask is, do we think we generally have an obligation to refrain from contributing to really massive harms? And I think the answer is clearly yes. And we can see this in really simple examples, like if you are taking your refuse to the recycle bin after a lunch, right? And there's a recycle bin, a compost bin, and a trash bin, and you know perfectly well where each of the pieces go, and they're all right beside one another, but you just decide to lazily throw it all in the trash, I think you've done wrong. Now, your tiny little bit of trash makes virtually no difference, right? But what happens there is I think you have an obligation to not contribute to these sorts of massive systematic problems. And so then we should ask ourselves, well, does procreating contribute to the sorts of problems that we're facing? And I don't know if you want to get into the data on kind of how much, but the answer is not only that procreation contributes to climate change, but that it is likely the most significant action an individual can take in terms of their carbon footprint.
Interesting. Well, yeah. How does our population affect climate change?
Okay. So when we're talking about the individual level, the question that we want to ask is something like, what does having a child do to my carbon footprint? It turns out that's a really, really hard question because part of what's built into the idea of carbon footprint is, you know, what I'm responsible for, what I'm morally responsible for. So there's a really intuitive idea that when I have a child, I'm obviously doing something that's very serious emission-wise because my child might have more children and those children might have more children and so on ad infinitum. And that's a lot more than I can do, you know, compared to, say, switching to a hybrid vehicle, right? That's got what a couple of scientists have called a carbon legacy that continues on into the future. So that's intuitive, but these scientists out at Oregon that coined the term carbon legacy, they tried to come up with an idea of what the numbers might actually be like. And what they said is, you know, we have to assume up front kind of what fraction of future emissions one is responsible for. And so we're just going to say that you are responsible for the emissions of your offspring, basically to the degree that you share a genetic relationship with them. So the formula is one half to the N, where N is the number of generations away from you. So you and your partner are both responsible for one half of your children's emissions, for one quarter of your grandchildren's, one eighth of your great grandchildren's, and so on. And that formula allowed them to crunch the numbers and find out under different scenarios how much one's carbon footprint increases. So the answer is really, really distressing. If we were to continue on business as usual for enough generations to run this calculation, which certainly I hope we don't, but it's a good number to have, that would result in increasing your carbon emissions by about 6 times your entire lifetime carbon emissions, right? So everything else you do in your life summed up, for every child you have, you increase your carbon footprint by about 6 times.
What is your response to people who tell you that you're overreacting about this, that and that climate change isn't going to be so bad anyway?
Well, you know, I mean, obviously, I would love it if it were true that I'm overreacting, but I just don't think the science bears it out. I don't want to be too much of a downer here, but people in the media don't like to say, you know, just here's how bad the situation is. There's a kind of unspoken rule that you're always supposed to kind of give hope, like here's the message. And I always do want to say at the end, like, here are the things we can do, right? Decarbonize the economy, you know, work on lowering fertility. But there's also a whole bunch of facts at the front end that are relevant. And those facts are that we are nowhere near on pace to do any of the things that we've said are important. You know, we said that 2 degrees Celsius rise over pre-industrial temperature average is a limit that we should never cross. And then at Paris last year at COP21, we said, no, that's actually too lenient, which a lot of us have been saying for years. We should actually aim for 1.5 degree as a threshold for what's really dangerous to the planet. But we're probably already nearly locked into 1.5 by virtue of, you know, the fact that we can't decarbonize overnight. And we are not doing anything like what would be required to reduce emissions enough to keep us from crossing 2 degrees threshold. So as a matter of fact, if everybody who signed on to the Paris Accords, which is our first real significant movement ever, if everybody did exactly what they said, and everybody kept their word, and there wasn't anything like a presidential election in the U.S. that allowed a climate denier to win and tank the, you know, clean power plant or something. If all of that happened, we still might get a 3.7 degree Celsius rise by 2100, which is catastrophic. That's not just bad. That's really, really bad. So that's a long answer, and there's way more science that we could talk about, but it's just the situation is not good. And if we keep acting like, oh, climate change is a problem for the future, we should probably do something about it, we're not taking it seriously enough. Climate change is a problem for us now, for our kids, for the next generations. And if we don't act, it's going to get bad.
We are talking with Travis Reeder. He's a bioethicist. He is the author of the book Toward a Small Family Ethic, How Overpopulation and Climate Change Are Affecting the Morality of Procreation. And he also wrote a piece on how the climate crisis calls for having fewer children. And we wonder what you think about this. Do you think couples should limit the number of children that they have because of climate change? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. According to our guest bioethicist, having fewer children is a move that we should consider as we look to the future of our planet. He says, in an era of climate change, we should limit the number of children that we have. And we welcome your questions for him, and we welcome your own experiences, your own views on this. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. He says, maybe we should protect our kids by not having them. Travis Reeder is the Assistant Director of Education Initiatives and a research scholar at the Berman Institute of Bioethics at Johns Hopkins University. He's also the author of the book Toward a Small Family Ethic, How Overpopulation and Climate Change Are Affecting the Morality of Procreation. Let's take some calls. Our lines are full. Anne in Green Bay is with us. Hi, Anne.
Good morning. Well, first of all, I want to say thank you for writing the book and using the words climate crisis, because we are in a climate crisis, and people just don't want to wake up to that idea. And as much as I commend you for what you're doing, I think it's going to take decades for us to change our ways, because we are a very selfish, greedy society, and unfortunately, we don't have decades to change our ways. But I commend you for what you're doing.
Well, thanks, Anne. Sorry, Joy, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, do you agree with Anne that we're not going to change our ways? We're selfish?
Oh, gosh. I mean, I don't want to be quite so pessimistic, but, you know, right before the break, I was saying that the situation is pretty dire, and so I'm afraid that I agree with Anne, at least, that it's going to be very, very hard. You know, one of the things that this gives us an opportunity to raise is that I'm obviously not suggesting that we talk about procreation as an alternative to doing all the other things we need to do. I'm talking about having smaller families as an addition to doing everything else we have to do. And so I assume that what Anne meant by greedy and selfish is that we just have shown no inclination that we're ready to give up our fancy toys, and we just have to. And so we have to decarbonize our economy, and we have to help developing nations develop with clean energy, and we have to decrease fertility rate, and we just have to do it all at the same time.
Yeah. In the story for National Public Radio, you were quoted as saying, maybe we should protect our kids by not having them. What kind of moral duty do we have to our children and future generations when it comes to this?
Yeah, so that's another good point. So far, we've been talking about what we can think of as altruistic reasons that are kind of outward facing towards the population for not procreating. And so when my wife and I were talking about whether or not to have a child, we were having a very careful reason debate about what the addition of a person is going to do to everybody else, because it increases their carbon footprint by so much. But of course, there's another consideration as well, which is you should not be having the conversation, I would say, most ethicists in this area would say, without thinking about the effects on the life that you're creating. And so this is not a new thought at all, that sometimes the world is, you know, kind of dark enough that we should worry that the child we're bringing into it will not benefit by being brought into the world. And there are all sorts of really sticky philosophical problems with this idea. But I think most people actually find this plausible. If you think about the recommendations in light of the Zika outbreak and this very serious problem with microcephaly in infants born to patients with Zika, you know, government said, don't get pregnant while there's this Zika outbreak, which is worth a whole bioethical conversation in and of itself. But an interesting point there is that everybody kind of seemed to rush to endorse the idea that when there's a great risk to the child, for the child's sake, you shouldn't have it. And if we really believe that, well, if Anne and people who think like her are right, that the situation is pretty threatening, that might be a reason to not bring another child into the world.
Let's go to Nathaniel in Milwaukee next. Hi, Nathaniel.
Hi. Thanks for having me. I was going to call and say, I think you're, as somebody who has been arguing for dealing with global warming for years, I was going to say I thought your guess was 90% wrong. He actually got himself in a little bit better favor by talking about or mentioning we ought to decarbonize our economy. But if you look at real-world emissions, when China instituted its relatively successful population control program, where they rapidly decreased their birth rate, notably, the amount of emissions China put out actually had an increasing rate of rise rather than a decreasing rate. And that was simply because it wasn't the number of children being born, it was their industrialization program and how that industrialization went about, which was increasing the number of coal-fired power plants, which a country builds regardless of how many children are being born. And I think that carbon is the proper focus.
All right. What do you think of that, Travis?
As he was saying in his kind of preamble there, I think that Nathaniel and I actually agree on most of it, except that if China had continued to grow their population while industrializing, their emissions would have gone out more. Per capita emissions times the number of capitas, right, the individuals. So it's not just that they were industrializing, it's that there were a bunch of people there to use the energy. And then, of course, there are all sorts of problems with global export and trade. And it's really hard to figure out how to allocate responsibility when you do that. But the basic idea is that there are two halves to this problem. There is consumption and use and, you know, the emission side. And there is the number of people doing the consuming, the use, the emissions. And so for every argument that Nathaniel and someone who's wanting to focus on that side makes about shouldn't we reduce emissions, shouldn't we decarbonize the economy, shouldn't we do these things, the answer is obviously yes. And then if you have fewer people clamoring for the resources we are using, that's going to be all for the better. And we have good data to support this now. A recent study that I cite in my work shows that there is a completely unsurprising, nearly perfect one-to-one correlation between population growth and emission rise. So it just, you know, like I say, completely unsurprising. It does matter that the number of people we have emitting, no matter what else we do.
Next, we go to Juliet in Eau Claire. Hi, Juliet.
Hello. Good morning. I wasn't sure I'd be able to get on the air. I wanted to comment, and it's very similar, actually, to what Nathaniel said, is that I spent many years feeling very guilty because I have more than my two kids, and I'm very active in environmental issues and regulating consumption. But I've come to find out that when all things are equal, again, it seems as though my friends who have less children consume more than I do with my five children. I can sustain a family of six on my average income, and people who have less kids have more expendable income and definitely tend to consume a lot more in terms of gas and all other things. So it really, I was surprised when he said rises at a one-to-one rate, because it would definitely seem like in the consumer-based society that we live in, that people consume more with more expendable income. And so it's really much more about education and in turn then as well limiting population, but more about education of consumerism.
Yeah. So, Travis, Juliet might have a smaller carbon footprint than the Joneses, if the Joneses don't don't do the right things.
Yeah, that's totally plausible. And I get that message from a lot of people. Actually, I get very nice, thoughtful emails from folks like Juliet. Maybe she's already emailed me. I don't know. I think that the first thing I should say is having this conversation is not about blaming anyone. So it makes me cringe a little bit that Juliet says that, you know, she's feeling guilty about having more than her two. That's not the purpose of this conversation, right? The purpose of this conversation is to have a society-wide discussion of whether or not we should start to change the norms. And, you know, most of the folks who have larger families did it without, you know, having any thought that this might be harmful or bad in any way. And, you know, they love kids and they love families, and these are obvious goods and values. So there's no casting aspersions here. It's about whether or not we should change our culture. And so that's thing one. But the second point is the idea that, you know, having expendable income then can make the Joneses actually emit more just goes back precisely to my response to Nathaniel. So we need to not let them use that money to buy fossil fuels, right? I mean, this is one half of the problem, but I think the opposition, the tendency by people who really don't like what I'm saying, is to say you're focusing on the wrong thing. And my response is just always going to be, we have to focus on all the things, right? So the thing about having the five kids or the eight kids or the 11 kids or however many, or even the one, like my one, right, is that they are not going to be just our kids and just our expenses while we are mindfully raising them. They are going to go on to be procreative agents of their own and make their own decisions. And then they are probably going to have kids, right? So we all kind of sit on the top of this iceberg of future emissions going on, you know, indefinitely. And so the little tiny bit that we have control over when they're in our house and we're raising them with the kind of proper green values is just a small fraction of the emissions that making them makes us responsible for.
Travis Reeder is our guest. He is a bioethicist at Johns Hopkins University. He is the author of the book Toward a Small Family Ethic, How Overpopulation and Climate Change Are Affecting the Morality of Procreation. And he recently wrote a piece for The Conversation, which was titled Bioethicist, The Climate Crisis Calls for Fewer Children. We welcome your questions for him. We welcome your thoughts on this. Should we be having smaller families? Should couples have fewer children because of climate change? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Jesse in Prairie du Chien is with us next. Hi, Jesse.
Hi, how's it going?
Pretty good. What's your thought?
I definitely think we should be focused on smart population growth, and it also, you know, it's going to take working in tandem with, you know, environmental awareness, sort of just a culture shift in terms of what's important to us and how are we going to sustain the environment. I guess I'm very aware of these issues, and a lot of that's been fostered through what I've learned in college. But it doesn't seem like most people are that concerned with sustainability and just the overall health of the environment. I'm just kind of wondering, what is it going to do to, or what is it going to take to change our culture and make more people, you know, environmentally aware and concerned about these issues? Because it seems to be sort of a pressing issue here and now and not just into the future. So,
Thank you, Jesse. So what's it going to take, Travis?
Oh, gosh. You know, the $10 million question. Jesse's asking me to prognosticate a little bit, and that's not my area of expertise. But, of course, all of us who think about this have our own kind of view. My impression of humans is that we are exceptionally good at responding to crises when they get really bad, which is often too late. You know, one kind of concern, as we started the show with, is that it's already a bit too late. You know, we could have been decarbonizing our economy 20 years ago and we wouldn't be in this situation. I think this year might have been the start of it, to be honest. You know, I've gotten a lot of people asking me, why are your ideas getting airtime? Why are they taking off? Why do people want to talk to you about this now? And it didn't seem that surprising since, you know, my book came out and these papers came out right about the same time that we set, you know, two consecutive records for the hottest month, right about the time that we had, you know, several once in a thousand year floodings, right about the same time that we had heat domes over the Middle East, you know, that gave us heat indexes of 165 degrees Fahrenheit. When you have this many climate related events making the news, and then you go back and read the climate predictions by the scientists who were most worried in the late 90s and early 2000s, this summer looks an awful lot like what people like Michael Mann, the author of the famous hockey stick graph, told us to look out for at the early stages of dangerous warming. And maybe next year we get a gift. You know, maybe next year things slow down and we get a cool year, and more of this was El Nino than we think. That would be fantastic. That would give us more time. But if next year looks like this, and the year after that looks like this, then I think maybe we start to see enough people getting hurt, and sadly, enough people having their wallets hurt when their you know, very expensive houses on the coastlines are being constantly threatened, that maybe that does it. Maybe that snaps us out of the fog. So not the brightest answer, Jesse. I'm sorry about that, but maybe we are at least at the beginning.
Yeah, thanks, Jesse, for the call. Let's go next to Christine in La Crosse. Hi, Christine.
Hi. Well, I have a question, and maybe you don't want to go into this area, but I've used this argument when arguing that people should be allowed to choose whether or not to have an abortion. And I just wondered your guest's thoughts on whether or not these findings would be used more and more when it comes to that discussion, and I guess just what your general thoughts are on that.
Have some general thoughts on that, Travis?
I do. So I think this is a really good line of questioning. I'm not at all worried to go down this road, but I think that we have to frame it in a certain way. So I think that the less helpful way to frame it, especially in our political climate, is to say something like, you know, we need fewer people, and so we should be allowed to abort more fetuses. I think that would strike many people as very morally distressing because the reasoning doesn't seem quite right. Not to say that there's not a good argument to be made, but I think that would be politically problematic. The way that this ties in really, really clearly, however, is that groups who are really concerned about population, and there are these groups, are very concerned about family planning in general. And the reason is when women have access to family planning services of all kinds, and access to basic health care, and when all citizens of a nation are being educated, especially women, fertility rates drop. This is just what we've seen the world over for years and years and years. And so what this indicates to demographers, to people who think about this, is that very often, this is obviously not the case for everyone. Some people want big families and they see, you know, a very particular good in that. But a lot of people have large families because, you know, a huge percentage of births are still unplanned. Pregnancies are unplanned. So what you might think then is that abortion, like contraception, like family planning and education, like basic health care, are these goods that are required by justice. And that when everybody has access to them, that will serve as a major component in the fight against overpopulation.
And I would presume that you would not be advocating for some sort of policy that would mandate how many children people can have?
No, no, not at all. So we started off a little bit earlier in the hour saying that there are different sides to this, and we've largely been talking about the morality side, you know, what should you do, what should I do? And there's the other side, which is how do you adopt policies that allow us to have healthy population stability, sustainability? And on that policy side, I think almost everyone, part of the conversation, agrees the policy can't be, you know, there's a law for, you know, you only have one child and everyone else is killed. Like, that's not a policy under consideration. So there are much more nuanced considerations than that.
Michelle on Facebook says, what if one of your children solves the climate problem through research or finds a way to postpone it for a long time? It's a possibility. Everyone has reasons to have however many kids they want. Figure it out for yourself and you'll be happy. So what about that, Travis? Hey, maybe that child I don't have might solve the climate change crisis.
Well, so I get this answer a lot, as she's probably unsurprised to hear. So the big problem with this is there's actually a little bit of literature on this question, and one philosopher has dubbed this sort of response a little bit snidely, so I wouldn't put it this way, but they call it the pass the buck and hope objection, right? That you go ahead and do the thing that you want to do, and what we'll do is we'll imbue our hopes in the next generation that these people we're creating will actually solve the problem. So the issue with that is that it's just, it's not a very, it's not the mode of reasoning I would want to recommend, right? So when we're deciding how many children to have, what we could think about every problem we face, climate change, overpopulation, food shortages, water shortages, right? Biodiversity loss. About all of these, we could say, you know what the problem is? We don't have enough brilliant people. So here's the new push. Everybody have as many kids as they want, and then we'll have better chances of finding, you know, the geniuses that'll solve this. But of course, that would be absolutely catastrophic, right? So as long as you believe that a planet with finite resources can't support infinite population growth, we can't hope that everybody has as many children as they want looking for the, you know, the needle in the haystack. So we've already got a lot of bodies and a lot of brilliant people. So here's what I would suggest is a better methodology. We should invest heavily in education and in helping people who do exist to, you know, reach the greatest heights, right? And when we're deciding whether or not to have another child, we should do the probabilities a little bit more carefully. So here's a guarantee when you have another child, they will be an emitter and they will contribute to the problem. Here's a very, very, very small fraction that they will be the singular person who solves this problem, right? So for every kid that we have, we just have to understand that they will, in fact, add to the problem and that there's this very, very small likelihood that they'll do something massive to contribute to it. And when you run those numbers over and over again, I think that you still come out with the conclusion that we just have to be careful, and instead we invest in the people who already exist.
We will take a short pause, and then we will welcome more calls for our guest, Travis Reeder, who is the author of a piece for The Conversation. We have posted this on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Bioethicist says, the climate crisis calls for fewer children. He is also the author of the book, Toward a Small Family Ethic, How Overpopulation and Climate Change Are Affecting the Morality of Procreation. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. We are talking about whether or not we should have fewer children to help save the planet. Our guest is a bioethicist who says that we should have fewer children if we want to make a difference in the era of climate change, as having children is a big way to add to your carbon footprint. What about you? Did you think about this before having children? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Let's take another call from Jerry in Glendale. Hi, Jerry.
Oh, hi, Jody. Thanks for this vital conversation today. I have a question. I'm 68 years old, and I remember back when Paul Ehrlich's book, The Population Bomb, came out in the late 60s. And for some period after that, there was quite a bit of encouragement for people to be conscious about the number of children they brought into the world. Then over the last 30 years, that particular aspect of the equation seems to have dropped right off the radar screen. And there's such an emphasis placed upon consumer things that people are using up in the environment, and not much talk at all. I haven't heard anybody talk about population control. What happened that particular aspect really dropped off the radar screen of people's conversations?
Do you know why that dropped off our radar screens, Travis?
Well, that's a great question. I have some ideas. You know, I'm not a historian, but obviously this is a very interesting question. So I can give a couple of suggestions. I mean, Paul would be a great question to talk to, a great person to talk to. But right. So Paul Ehrlich with his wife Anne write this book, The Population Bomb, I think it was 68 or so. And there was an era of very kind of concerted reflection on this. Not among everybody, of course, but it did start a movement. And here are a couple of things I think really mattered. So the Ehrlichs, along with a couple of their core co-authors who did several other things together, made some very, very particular predictions. So they said things like, you know, within 10 years or within 20 years, this will be the rate of starvation, that sort of thing. And the problem with predictions for them is that they were dealing largely with food shortages. That was the big thing that they were concerned with. So today I'm framing this in terms of climate, but of course climate is not the only problem that our numbers exacerbate. So what the Ehrlichs didn't foresee is they didn't foresee the Green Revolution happening. And we suddenly had this kind of massive technological boom that allowed us to feed way more people than anyone in the late 60s thought we would be able to do. And that made all of their predictions falsified. And what's interesting is the Ehrlichs are still writing. Paul had a new piece out just this year at the beginning of the summer, I think, saying, you know, the population bomb then and now, you know, what's the new world look like? And he realizes what I think everybody should realize, which is that the fact that he got some dates wrong doesn't mean that the idea was wrong, because the idea was simply that a finite set of resources can't support an infinitely growing population. Yeah. And so he's recalculated. So I think the Green Revolution was a big piece. The second piece that was really interesting is there was a big conference in Cairo, and it was the last place that I know of that really publicly among governments, along with the UN, people were trying to have the conversation of population control, and had gotten a little bit taboo and touchy it by that time. And the UN, I think I'm getting these details right, but listeners can look up the Cairo conference on population if they want. Basically, the UN said, we're not having this conversation anymore. It is an absolute fundamental human right that individuals are allowed to decide the spacing and number of their children. And that really killed the conversation. When I write on this stuff, most of my citations go back to the 70s, and then stop for 30 years.
Yeah, we have had Paul Ehrlich on the show in the past.
Oh, good.
You know, I'm just wondering, in terms of the state of the population bomb today, aren't we growing at a much slower rate? Or, I mean, I'm just wondering if you know, people aren't having families of eight like my parents did. They are typically having just a couple of kids. So is the, you know, what are you saying, that it's still too many?
Yeah, so absolutely, you're right, and thank goodness for that. When Ehrlich was writing, we were still on the tail end of a serious, serious problem with our doubling rates, and that's not true anymore. So the problem is that we're not at zero population growth yet, and we're certainly not at negative population growth yet. So depending on whether you look at the low, the median, or the high projections from the UN, we're on pace to hit around 10 billion people, between 9 and 10 billion by 2050 or shortly after, and then not actually peaking until 2100. Whereas if we lower it a little bit closer to the low fertility projections, we could actually peak around mid-century and start to reduce the population size. So the reason that that's really important, says someone with the concern set that I have, is that we're already in an ecological overshoot. We're already using resources faster than they can replenish themselves. And so when you look at the rate at which we're emitting carbon dioxide and the rate at which we're using arable land and how much water we're able to ship and these sorts of things, you know, we need about 50% more resources every year than the Earth has. So the population really needs to be smaller than it is now. So not only do we need to stop growing, we need to find a sustainable way, an economically sustainable way, to get the population down to a level that the Earth can handle on a long-term basis.
Jim in Waukesha called in but couldn't stay, and he wanted to say, we live in a world where we've got a purpose. Don't we have a responsibility to pass on our genes? It denies the world of who you are. What about that belief, or, you know, it's a moral obligation to have children?
So I do think there is a set of folks who believe this. I mean, you may have heard the Pope say this in the last year. I don't agree. So I don't agree for a couple of reasons. I was trying to think of a nicer way to put it than that. But I don't think that humans have one singular purpose. That belief was very popular in the past. It was popular with Aristotle in ancient Greece, and then it was popular with St. Thomas. And it's not hugely influential these days, but I think that if you live, you know, child-free by choice, which is kind of a hashtag these days, if you live a child-free by choice life, I don't think that has undermined your purpose in even the slightest. I think that there are lots of paths to a good life. So what moral philosophers like to talk about is the good life, or the happy life, or the flourishing life. I think there are lots and lots of paths, and having children is certainly one of them. I mean, as I've said, I have a child, and it is a huge part of my good life. But then there's the second point, which is that having a child doesn't imply having unlimited children, right? So even if you thought that it was really important, even if not obligatory, to pass on your genes or something, even if you thought that, which I don't, then you could still think, well, once you've done it once, or maybe once you've done it twice, then you no longer have any impetus for continuing to do so.
Keith in Milwaukee is with us now. Hi, Keith.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I agree with the guest that we can't sustain unlimited population growth. But I think if you look at things from an economic perspective, if we don't have a birth rate that exceeds our death rate, we won't be able to, over the long term, sustain the kind of economy that we're going to need in order to solve the world's climate problems. China, they're saying, in 20 years is going to have a real economic problem on their hand because their birth rate is so low. And so I'm curious how the guest feels about that, and I'll take my comments off the air.
Okay, what about that?
So thanks, Keith. I think this is a really important question. It's another one that I get a lot. So there were kind of two parts. One was, you know, isn't this going to hurt the economy? But then he asked a really smart version of that, which is, isn't it going to hurt the economy enough that that'll hinder our ability to fight climate change? So I think that the answer to the first part is yes, that it's going to hurt the economy, and we'll talk more about it. But the second part, isn't it going to hurt the economy enough to hinder our fight in climate change? I don't see that there's any good evidence for that. And so so now the question is, well, you're admitting it's going to hurt the economy. You know, what's the deal? Well, our economy is built on infinite growth. And so here's just a really unfortunate fact. That economy is going to be hurt, right? Because, once again, I think this is the third time I've said it, finite resources can't support infinite growth. So we've built a serious problem into our economic engine, and we need to figure out how to fix that. Now, work has been started, so there's some interesting work that I really want to get more familiar on steady-state economics. And, you know, Japan, Germany, Italy, these are countries that are already struggling with the problem that Keith was predicting for China. And some of them are really unhappy. So Italy, I think, has a much higher rate of kind of anger about the problem. Whereas Japan just said, there was a really interesting article about the Japanese leadership saying, hey, this is an opportunity for us. We are going to move forward and do incredible things with our new version of what the economy is made for. So this is obviously a conversation. I guess the big answer to Keith is, this is obviously a conversation that absolutely has to be had. If you think that we eventually have to curb our numbers, then we absolutely have to reconsider our view of the economy, and then we have to do it in a smart, thoughtful way, looking to the future, so that we don't damage the economy enough to harm humans, which is what we're trying to avoid in the fight against climate change, or to undermine our ability to take the fight to climate change.
Yeah. Well, I know you said you weren't terribly optimistic in the beginning, but you're still getting the conversation going. Do you think that individuals will heed this call?
You know, I just have to hope so. What else do we do, right? We are in the fight for our lives. We're in the fight for our planet, and there's certainly no benefit in being defeatist. You know, that nothing makes me more angry than somebody who wants to write into a paper or something just to say, we're all in trouble, you know, humanity is doomed, you know, let's go out with a party. Like, that's not helpful. So it's true that I'm not optimistic that we can do all the things that I think we ought to have done starting 20 years ago. I just don't think it's possible that we limit global warming to 1.5 degrees or even 2 degrees. But here's what I still have hope for, and I just have to, because we have to have enough hope to motivate action. I have hope that we can avoid 4 degrees, which would be catastrophe, right? I have hope that we can band together and decarbonize the economy and do really amazing things before the world gets so bad that we've lost a lot of our ability to do that. That's the future we have to look forward to.
Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Travis Reeder, Assistant Director of Education Initiatives, a research scholar at the Berman Institute of Bioethics at Johns Hopkins University. Author of the book Toward a Small Family Ethic and a piece that he wrote for The Conversation, Bioethicist, The Climate Crisis Calls for Fewer Children. Thanks to Brianne Chasso and to Kai Brito for producing this program. Thank you for listening. I hope you stay tuned. There's much more to come. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.